Hello, and welcome to New Books in Geography. I'm your host, Bob Wilson, Associate Professor of Geography in the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. Climate change has been very much in the news during 2016. This year will most likely be the hottest year on record. Extreme drought and searing heat have fanned wildfires in Fort McMurray, Alberta, last May, and in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, this November. Meanwhile, the Arctic has also had record high temperatures, leading one climate researcher to say that the region itself is unraveling. Yet for the most part, these climate-related events and dire warnings from climatologists have fallen on deaf ears, especially in the United States, where climate change denial is firmly entrenched, especially among Republican lawmakers. But why is that? In his recent book, Behind the Curve, Science and the Politics of Global Warming, Josh Howe seeks to answer this question. Howe, a historian at Reed College, traces the history of climate change from a scientific oddity in the late 1950s to a topic of heated debate among politicians and environmental activists who feared the failure to address global warming will lead to stronger storms, fiercer wildfires, and rising seas. Part history of science and part history of environmentalism, Behind the Curve is a provocative book exploring one of the most vexing issues of our time. So, Josh, welcome to New Books in Geography.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Your book is called Behind the Curve, and the curve being a reference to the Keeling Curve. So what is the Keeling Curve, and why did this graph become an icon in the history of global warming?
The Keeling Curve is it's an icon in part because of its simplicity. It's a simple plot of CO2 as measured over time in the atmosphere at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii and at research stations around the globe. What's powerful about this this curve is that you don't actually need to know a whole lot to realize that it is a key marker of climate change. There's sort of three very simple things you need to know. One, you need to know that CO2 acts to warm the Earth by absorbing energy from the sun. Two, you need to know that CO2 is rising. And three, you need to know that humans are causing that rise. And so those are insights from science that are actually well-established and have been established for more than half a century. That first insight that CO2 causes the Earth to warm, or that I guess CO2 traps energy, is derived from the insights of a scientist named John Tyndall, who between 1859 and 1862 did a series of experiments using an instrument called a ratio photospectrometer to measure the opacity of gases. It found that CO2, in fact, helps to regulate the temperature of the Earth. The second is an insight from 1896 when this Swedish divorcee named Svante Arrhenius, going through a kind of a horrible custody battle, decided to take out his frustrations on some mathematical calculations and calculated that a doubling of CO2 would increase the temperature of the Earth by around 5 degrees Celsius. And he's just a little bit outside the top of the IPCC range for a doubling of CO2. But actually remarkably close.
Yeah, that's amazing how accurate he was, given how how primitive his calculations in some ways, his ability to make these calculations were, but yet very accurate in the end.
Scientists, of course, will tell you that he came to a good conclusion for the wrong reasons. It is somewhat remarkable, however, how close he was.
Yeah.
And then the last insight is actually, it's one of the most important ones, because I think there's a lot of skepticism, even if people accept the reality of climate change, the skepticism over humans' role in that change. And that was the insight that humans are, in fact, increasing the CO2 in the atmosphere. It's derived from the studies of a radio geochemist named Hans Suess in the 1950s, who realized that the CO2 that's in the atmosphere now is irradiated with has carbon-14 in it. And there should be a certain ratio of carbon-14, so irradiated carbon, to sort of normal carbon or carbon-12. But when you measure that, what you find is there's way more carbon-12 than there should be, given just what's out there in the atmosphere. And the source for that has got to be some carbon that hasn't been irradiated and in which the irradiated carbon has decayed. The only reasonable source for that is fossil fuel carbon. That ratio tells us that humans contribute carbon to the atmosphere. So what the curve shows you in aggregate is that secular increase of CO2 over time from about 315 parts per million when Keeling first started measuring to just over 400 parts per million, which is where we are now. The other thing that's interesting about this curve is once you get into it, you realize it's actually not one curve, but it's two. There's a oscillating line. So a line that's sort of wavy that goes, if you're looking at the plot from left to right, bottom to top, the oscillations are annual fluctuations of carbon, where in the spring and summer months, carbon overall across the globe decreases in the atmosphere because it's taken up by the stems and shoots of the plants in the northern hemisphere. And in the fall and winter, carbon increases because plants drop those leaves and shoots. Most of the plants are in the northern hemisphere. So you have that fluctuation. And that's a natural cycle, right? It's pretty easy to see this is like a cycle of nature. But when you look at that oscillating curve in aggregate, you see that mapped onto that annual cycle of variation is a secular cycle, sort of multi-decadal, where that natural cycle has been turned on its side. So the power here is that the curve capitalizes on what we think about nature as stable and shows how humans have turned that stability, kind of tilted it on its side and created something new.
One of the things, kind of moving on a little bit, is kind of the context in which Charles Keeling starts taking these measurements and his connection to a very well-known climate scientist named Roger Revelle. One of the interesting things I got from the book is that climate science, at least in the United States, is very much a child of the Cold War. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What's the connection between climate science at that time and the Cold War?
Yeah, I mean, it happens in a couple of senses. And I think the first thing to understand is the importance of integrating climate change into a Cold War research program. And for me, there's no better character than Roger Revelle to be an emblem of this. And there's a couple of images of him that really tell the story. So the first, and this one is in the book, you see Revelle on the back of this ship in the 1930s. It's E.W. Scripps. It's the Scripps Institute's big oceanographic vessel. And he looks for all the world like James Dean. You know, he's got this black overcoat on. Yeah, and his hair is all tousled, and he's like thin, and he's standing over these specimens that he's gathering. And he's clearly doing science. But the way the picture looks, he is a human just far too big for the little science that he's doing. Which is kind of emblematic of the way he was as a character in life, because he was a very good science entrepreneur, and he helped integrate climate science, which he was interested in, particularly CO2 monitoring, into a number of different avenues of research that were funded through the Cold War and the National Science Foundation. The second image is of him about 25 years later, and this one's not in the book. He's standing next to these secretaries of various agencies, and he's much plumper and has less hair and is wearing a tie that's too short, and is clearly sort of he's obsequious to these people who are controlling this funding. There's this kind of two sides to the coin of how climate science becomes part of the Cold War. On the one hand, the Cold War interest in geophysical systems as part of competition with the Soviet Union enables climate scientists to take advantage of all this infrastructure across both the U.S. and the world, and particularly to tap into something called the International Geophysical Year that occurred for 18 months between 1957 and 1958 in order to conduct their science. And that's great, and they love it, and they need that in order to access this global space. At the same time, however, they're really worried about becoming tools of what Eisenhower is later going to call the military-industrial complex. And much of what they're studying is born of the same kinds of anxiety that Americans more broadly have of nuclear energy and nuclear conflict. So when they start worrying about the impacts of CO2 once they begin studying it, that's part of the same Cold War moment that enables them to study that phenomenon in the first place.
Well, one of the things I find interesting is that environmentalism starts emerging in the 60s and 70s. And part of the reason environmentalism emerges when it did is because of concerns about nuclear weapons and nuclear fallout. But at least initially, environmentalists didn't focus much on the threat of climate change. And my sense from reading your book is that the climate scientists regarded environmentalists a bit warily. So you can talk more a little bit about this relationship between the growing environmental movement and climate science at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand when we write about scientists as scholars of science studies and historians, often we will caricature them, right? We'll create these categories, and each individual scientist has their own story and is generally going to work every day to do their job and not necessarily thinking about these things. But as a group, I think scientists in general and climate scientists in particular espouse a certain level of conservatism when it comes to advocacy. There's a sort of professional code among climate scientists that I saw almost throughout the research, until the most recent political conversations, of backing off of the kinds of advocacy, particularly radical advocacy, that characterized environmental groups in the 1960s. And so I think the anxieties that climate scientists had about the impacts of CO2 in the 60s and 70s mirror the anxieties that people like Rachel Carson and even like other scientists like a Barry Commoner or Paul Ehrlich have about environmental issues. Climate scientists back off of those in part because they derive their authority from their dispassionate approach to politics, and they are interested in advocating for more and better science, but not for being tagged as some sort of political radical. At the same time, in order to be politically radical, in order to make change in the world, environmentalists need issues to resonate locally. So Rachel Carson's Silent Spring is so resonant in part because it talks about everybody's backyard.
Absolutely.
Climate change doesn't really fit that rubric in the 1960s. It's still very abstract and very technical. In order to understand it, you essentially need to, in the 60s, be a scientist. There's not a lot of people communicating this very well yet. So the environmental community, they have much closer to home issues than sort of more low-lying fruit to pick than this abstract issue of climate change. And that happens well up into the 1980s. There's this great memo from the head of the Sierra Club that defines the environmental issues
that
the Sierra Club
is
detective. And I mean, it almost defines exactly what climate change is not in terms of being tangible, in terms of being accessible to the public. So it's very much a I'm going to turn the stereo on behind me. I hope that doesn't.
No, I can't. I don't hear anything right now. So
okay,
we'll
all right,
keep going.
Great. Anyway, the sorry for that technical blip. So the environmental community is kind of separated not just by the predisposition toward objectivity of scientists, but also the local focus of environmental groups, particularly in the 1960s and 70s.
Okay. Well, first on the side, your audio is still fine. But I want to connect this to, so you talk about, kind of a little bit of the wariness of climate scientists and their striving to remain objective or to be seen as objective. But they do work with some policymakers. And if I understand you correctly, you call this sort of a science first discourse, but that this science first discourse over time, it kind of limits their effectiveness in the policy realm. So can you tell me a little bit about what you mean by this science-first discourse?
Sure. I mean, I think what you see, particularly in the 1970s, is scientists become more and more concerned about the impacts of CO2-induced climate change, is a move to use organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences to promote not just more research, but a better interface between scientific research and policymaking. But there's an assumption here that more and better science in the right hands, the right political hands, will lead to good decision making. And it is an assumption that is that ignores a political process. So
absolutely.
When I'm looking through the records of the AAAS, for example, I see the science advisor for a congressman from California who sums it up as something called the forcing function of knowledge. He's convinced that more and better science placed in policymakers' hands will make for good policy. And in fact, for a while, that actually seems to work relatively well. You have the National Climate Policy Act of, I think, 1978. You have an increasing national profile of climatic issues. And you get it from a bunch of different sectors. I mean, agriculture really wants more information about climate change. I think environmentalists begin to be interested in the problem in the late 1970s. And so it's this kind of public service rooted in science. But it relies largely on executive agencies, and there's no real legislation behind it. So what happened is that the science first approach, which is in some ways top down, it ignores the populace, it ignores democracy more or less. It's technocratic. Yeah. It's vulnerable to political change, and that political change comes in just crystal clear focus in the person of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about what happens during the 1980s, which is often seen as a terrible time for American environmentalists, but it was also a challenging time for climate scientists, too.
Well, what happens in the early 1980s is that the Reagan administration nominates a series of appointees for executive agencies, including the EPA, the Department of Energy, and elsewhere, the Department of Interior. And through those proxies, the administration cuts funding for just about all social science and environmental science research across the federal budget. So the example that stands out to me is the Solar Energy Research Institute, just now the National Renewable Energies Lab in Boulder, Colorado. Mm-hmm. It's brand new. It's headed by this guy, Dennis Hayes, who is an interesting character who comes up a bunch of different times, different circumstances in the book, and was one of my favorite interviews talking to him because he had so much insight into the different periods of environmentalism. He takes over this thing called the Solar Energy Research Institute in Boulder under Carter, and everyone's really excited about this research. Literally within a year of Reagan taking office, having hired away scientists from universities, tenured scientists, senior scientists from universities across the country, they slashed the budget of the Solar Energy Research Institute by more than 70%, and these scientists get essentially 2 weeks' notice. And you see this happening across the spectrum of the environmental sciences, and climate scientists get hit by this pretty hard. NCAR sees a restriction of the kinds of things that they are funded for. This is the National Center for Atmospheric Research in the 1980s. What's really interesting about this for me is that politically this actually creates commonality between environmentalists and climate scientists in a new way that leads them to work together. And they work together through a couple of what are called Atari Democrats. So these few Democrats who are technologically savvy and environmentally concerned who come to power in the middle of the 1980s. And
Would Al Gore be one of those?
He is the prototypical Atari Democrat at this time. And as a historian, you have to remember that Al Gore is not yet Al Gore in the 1980s. Yes. He's not the Al Gore, the former future president of the United States. That hasn't happened yet. He's very dynamic and lesser known, but increasingly influential in congressional politics because he's really smart and he's really savvy about upcoming issues in the 1980s. So what happens with these cuts is that Reagan essentially drives these disparate groups who have been wary of each other together, and they work more or less outside the channels of government to begin this kind of moment of political engagement for climate science that looks very hopeful. Even though they're kind of working, against the dominant political discourse at the time.
So if I understand you correctly, what's happening during the 1980s is that climate scientists in the U.S. are increasingly tying their fate to American environmentalists, and particularly the Democratic Party during this time. Is that correct?
I think that's right. And I think that happens in large part as a reaction to what Samuel Hayes has called the Reagan anti-environmental revolution. Mm-hmm. You actually see a lot of old school Republican environmentalists switch parties too. And it polarizes that group significantly. It also coincides with this moment in more insularly in the history of climate science focused on the debate over something called nuclear winter. So part of what happens when Reagan cuts social and environmental science research budgets is climate scientists begin looking for new problems that engage with different sources of funding. And so one of those problems ends up being the climatic impacts of a potential nuclear exchange, which they get funding for through the Department of Defense. And led in part by Carl Sagan, but also by Steve Schneider, these scientists realize that the smoke and ash and dust from a nuclear exchange creates unprecedented climatic conditions that could lead to a substantial cooling of the earth, sufficient to impact agriculture and be really problematic. And the scenario, nuclear winter. Unfortunately, within that scientific community, there's some pretty bitter debate over the nature and extent of nuclear winter. And what it really is a proxy for a debate about what scientists' roles are as advocates. Whereas Sagan wants to push the extreme scenario because he's really concerned about nuclear policy. Some other scientists who agree with him in the main create political problems for Sagan and others by kind of toning down the scenario studies that that Sagan is promoting as drivers of policy. And they, that whole group on, I would say, generally the left, also comes into bitter contact with, I would say, more hawkish scientists, largely from astrophysics, who are supported by institutes on the right. And it creates a division within climate science that polarizes it in a new way. So at the very moment that I think climate scientists are becoming more politically savvy with their engagement with environmental organizations, they're also creating a heavily polarized climate within their own community that becomes a problem later.
Well, that's very helpful. And I want to come back to this question of scientists as advocates, particularly in more recent years. I know you have to go in about 10 or 15 minutes, but some other things that you discuss in the book, just to let listeners know, you have some really excellent chapters that talk about the development of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, better known as the IPCC in 1988, which later on in 2007 was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize along with Al Gore. And then you also talk about the Rio Summit and the development of sustainable development. In many ways, the main part of your book ends in the mid-1990s, but climate science has continued to evolve, as has the debate over how best to deal with global warming. So how have the main themes of your story continued to the present? Have they continued to the present, or have there been significant changes?
Well, I think some of the main themes, and particularly the science-first approach to climate change policy, has persisted, but it hasn't persisted unchanged. So one of the examples that I bring up in the epilogue of the book that will lead me into sort of more contemporary things is the Massachusetts versus EPA Supreme Court case between 2003 and 2007. And initially, this looks like something very different, right? This is putting regulation of CO2 into the hands of the courts, and it's led by environmental groups and by politicians and scientists as sort of backup. Once you read the case, however, what you realize is that the decision here is really a decision that puts the ball back into scientists' court by allowing the EPA to regulate CO2 based on the best available science, and the language is actually pretty vague about what the best available science is. It more or less just lets the legal community double down on the scientist must lead the way idea. It's not a bad decision necessarily, and I don't think it's necessarily even a bad way to make some good climate change policy, but it didn't necessarily change the game in the way that I think the plaintiffs in the suit had hoped it would. It didn't create the framework for a large national climate change policy that's comprehensive in any way. It was relatively narrow. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are some more mundane things that have totally changed the game. And I think these are actually really important considering the current political situation. And the first of these is the development of climate action plans in cities and states across the nation. These are comprehensive, democratically created plans with always in consultation with scientists and policymakers that map out how local communities and states and sometimes regions are going to mitigate climate change and adapt to climate change in the future. And this is a different kind of political engagement that actually, when I wrote the book, made me really hopeful. I think now it's the kind of last best hope in some ways, because I was hopeful that these would pave the way for national level policy.
Yes.
Now I'm kind of hopeful that states and municipalities will stick to their guns, and this will be a form of resistance to what is an erosion of national policy. So I think that has changed. I think the other thing that has changed is the attacks on scientists since about 2009, and this I didn't write about in the book, but I've been following, have been increasingly personal and increasingly vitriolic in ways that I think have really demoralized the scientific community and led many scientists to back off from certain types of climate change research for fear of isolation both within their institutions and from sources of funding. So in a more confidential conversation with the University of Chicago climate scientist, I learned that she and many of her colleagues have eliminated some of the language of climate change from their proposals for fear of raising red flags in either the National Science Foundation or the Department of Defense or from other funding sources, particularly in the case of a change of leadership in executive agencies.
I've heard of things such as this,
To me, there's a really pernicious trend that further erodes, the potential efficacy of a science-first approach, and that is that scientists are being dissuaded from taking it and making that interface happen. These are some of the changes that I see.
Well, let me talk a little bit more about climate scientists and some more recent trends. What do you make of the heightened advocacy of some climate scientists, such as James Hansen, Michael Mann, and Catherine Hayhoe? All of them in various ways have become, I would say, public intellectuals and ally themselves with various environmental activists, perhaps none more so than James Hansen, who, as you probably know, has been arrested many times at environmental protests and acts of civil disobedience. So do you see their actions as a real major departure from the rhetoric and actions of climate scientists in the past?
I do. I mean, I see this is one of the things that I think is well, let me say, I think it's a very intellectually and morally honest move for these scientists who have tried earnestly to work through the scientific community to highlight the dangers of climate change and found themselves undercut at every turn by a very politically oriented opposition to turn to politics themselves and go ahead and honestly say, okay, I'm not just about the science. I'm also about affecting change because I believe in this. The change, that is, I'm convinced by the evidence of climate change. And so I think, you know, Hansen's move, I'm not particularly drawn to Hansen as a leader, as an advocate, but I have a lot of respect for his honesty in retiring from NASA and making himself an overt advocate. And in some ways, I wish that it was politically viable for more scientists to do that. Unfortunately, I think with the current funding structure, there's a lot of disincentive to be both a scientist and an advocate.
Yes. Well, a few final questions. We're recording this podcast in December 2016, and we're still very much in the shadow of the momentous presidential election last month. And as you well know, Trump has called climate change a hoax perpetuated by the Chinese, and he has appointed climate change deniers to key positions in his administration. And last week, a few dozen scientists at the annual American Geophysical Union conference staged a protest against Trump's position on climate change. And so it seems in many ways we're preparing to see a repeat of the Reagan anti-environmental revolution of the 1980s. So in the face of this sort of obstruction, what can climate activists or climate scientists do?
This is a good question. I guess I would preface my answer with a clarification about the comparison to Reagan. I've been hearing this a lot. The comparison to Reagan is invidious for two reasons. One, I think that it softens the extent to which Reagan's policies in his first 4 years were a just total disaster for the American environment in a number of ways, particularly involving public lands and also the people who inhabited it. Because we always say, oh, well, we got through Reagan, we can get through this. So I think it does a disservice to just how destructive the Reagan administration was. Secondly, I think it is a disservice to Reagan, the Reagan administration, because the appointments that the president-elect has made appear, at least on the surface, to be so much less qualified than the Reagan appointees, and the potential impacts so much more dire. I'm incredibly worried about the environmental impact of a Trump presidency. And particularly, you know, climate change is one of those things that I'm worried about. I'm also as worried about public lands, and the link between public lands and climate change is an important one, where public lands provide a buffer for both species and humans against many of the impacts of climate change that the Trump administration has already suggested that they're going to begin to erode. In the face of this kind of policy, I think there are a couple of things that I see already happening that are really positive. The first is that cities and states, in the same way that they're becoming sanctuaries for immigrants in opposition to the president-elect's immigration policies, are essentially preparing to defy federal policy on climate change by sticking to their climate action plans and doubling down on the things they're already doing. And so I think that's a good thing. The other thing that I think both scientists and the interested public needs to do is in there, and I think there is a real outrage over this election, in their outrage, I think focusing on the mundane policies that come down through both the executive and through Congress and being vigilant about those in the press and also sort of on social media is really important, because it's easy through an outrage to lose sight of those mundane but very important details of policy.
Well, that's all really helpful, and I could continue talking about this all day, but I know you need to go. So, but before we leave, I want to ask you a little bit about what you're working on now, and then also about, you have a new book coming out that's an edited collection of primary documents about the history of climate change, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Making Climate Change History comes out in April of 2017 with the University of Washington Press. And it's a collection of primary source documents from the research that I did for Behind the Curve, with some additions based on some great feedback that I received from you and from some others, with essays that front those collected sources, helping to provide context for the sources, but also providing a guide for how to do this kind of history. And so it's as much about doing history as it is about climate change. And I think there's some good excitement for it, so I'm excited to see it in print coming up in 2017.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it too. So, why don't we bring this conversation to a close, Josh? I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk about this, and certainly with the election and climate change front and center in the news, I think your book is more important than ever. So thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me, Bob. It's always good to talk to you.